Okay. Welcome to episode 8. Is it really 8? Lord. Guys, welcome to episode 8 of Celluloid Fever Dreams. As always, I'm your host, Wyndham Jennings. And this week we got a film that had made my list of films that I wanted to talk about, but one that I wasn't sure I was going to get to this soon because I'm trying not to do too many movies from the same decade in a row or close together, and this will be my third film from the 80s, but I got a fan request and I decided I was going to go ahead and do it. So we're talking about 1988's Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, starring Cassandra Peterson, W. Morgan Shepherd, Evie McClurg, Kurt Fuller, and Jeff Conway. And yeah, this is... Elvira is pretty much a cult figure, and has been since the character was created in the late 70s as a movie show hostess and for an LA TV station. But you know, this was her first feature film in the character, well, as the main focus. Cassandra Peterson, before being Elvira, had done a couple of small parts. And I think she'd appeared as Elvira in a couple of movies previously. But this was the first time for the character taking a center role as the protagonist of a story. And other than Elvira's Haunted Hills in, I believe it was 99, it's the only time, only time she's been the main character for a film. And this movie, it's one of those that is kind of obscure and overlooked through no fault of anyone that worked on the actual film. You know, you can't lay the blame at just on the actors, because it's a really great cast. I mean, if you don't recognize any of the names, I mean, you can start a drinking game for this film just based off of, hey, isn't that person from that role in that movie? You know, to give you an idea, Edie McClurg, whose first feature film was 1976's Carrie, a lot of people, if you're fans of 80s movies, you'd recognize her from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. She plays the principal's secretary. Or Kurt Fuller, who plays a councilman in this film, was the mayor's assistant in Ghostbusters 2. And he was the television station executive in Wayne's World, which come out, was it the year after this, or 1990? And also had a role in Running Man. Jeff Conway, who plays the lead henchman for W. Morgan Shepherd's Vincent Talbot, who is Elvira's uncle in the film. Jeff Conway, he has a huge body of work. You'll probably know him, if you watch this film, from one of three places. He was Kinnicky, who was John Travolta's Danny's best friend from Greece. If you watch the TV show in the 80s, Taxi, he is Bobby Wheeler on that, struggling actor. And he played Zach Allen on Babylon 5. He's also one of my favorite short-lived 80s shows, Wizards and Warriors. But, I don't even know if you can find that anywhere. I think it only lasted maybe 10 episodes, but I really liked it. I mean, I was one of those weird kids that was into fantasy and sci-fi and bad movies, and a lot of my love of bad movies I can trace back to Elvira and Movie Macabre. But a couple of other notable names in the cast, just in small roles. At the beginning of the film, Elvira is still working for a TV station as a movie hostess. She gets into an argument with the local news anchor, who's played by Tress McNeil. And she's not done a whole lot of work in front of the camera, but as a voice actress, she's been the voice for Dot from Animaniacs, Babs from Tiny Toons. I'm not sure if she still is, but I know at one point she was the official voice of Daisy Duck. And Frank Welker, who isn't actually seen in the film, but provides a voice for Elvira's dog, Gonk, has been Fred Jones from the Scooby-Doo mysteries, series of shows since 1969 and took over the role of Scooby himself in 2002. And he also voiced Megatron, both for the 80s cartoon and I believe even the Michael Bay Transformer films. But he also voiced Soundwave, who was my absolute favorite character from the 80s Transformers cartoons. The movie was put out by New World Pictures, which was a Roger Corman company founded in 1970. And, oh, wait a minute, I forgot to talk about W. Morgan Shepherd. I mentioned him, but I kind of forgot to talk about his kind, you know, where you might know him from. First off, he's done a ton of movies and films. He appeared in one of my favorite, probably my favorite Nicolas Cage film. He's in Wild at Heart. It's Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern, and that's on my list of films to talk about on this show. We'll get to it soon, hopefully. He also appeared in Elephant Man. The one, if you're listening to this and you're like me and you're into sci-fi and stuff, the role you might recognize him from is Doctor Who. He played Canton Everett Delaware III, an FBI agent, Matt Smith's Doctor in Counters. He played the older version of him. From modern day, the younger version, who Matt Smith, who the Doctor, and Amy and Rory encounter first, is Mark Shepherd, who's W. Morgan Shepherd's son. It is one of three times they actually play the older and younger version of the same character. So I think that's a neat little wrinkle. You know, you play the younger version of your father, and on one occasion it's kind of cool. Three occasions, that's pretty awesome in my book. Mark Shepherd is, oh my God, he's done a ton of stuff. The most notable thing, the thing is probably when I say it's going to trigger a lot of you, is, oh yeah, that guy, he's Crowley on Supernatural. That's Mark Shepherd, who's W. Morgan Shepherd, who plays Vincent's son. Plays Vincent in this movie, that's his son. So, just a nice little, cute little trivia thing I like to pass along to you guys as I'm talking about the movie. But anyway, like I was saying, the film flopped hard when it hit theaters in 1988. It didn't get good reviews. Rotten Tomatoes, I don't think it has a good review as well. I don't really put a lot of stock into critics. I could probably do a episode on that. You know, old man rants at crowds kind of thing, but we're not going to go into that. I just don't put a lot of stock into critics or into sites that rate movies. Either I like it or I don't. I explained in an earlier episode, I kind of go along with Bruce Campbell's thing is, you know, it might not be a good movie, but it's entertaining. And if it's entertaining to me, that's enough. It's a good movie. But anyway, New World Pictures, Roger Corman, who is, if you don't know the name, Roger Corman is, his companies, his films, is responsible for so much of modern cinema. Especially 80s, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s. He had a knack. Roger Corman has made a career from B films and low budget films. He did the original Little Shop of Horrors, the musical version, 86, is still my favorite version. But the list of people, they actually call it the Corman Film School, because there are so many people who got their start on one of his films who went on to have huge careers and have huge hits and Oscars and, you know, all kinds of awards. I mean, just I just picked a few names at random off the list to give you an idea of Roger Corman. You know, in case some of you think, oh, the B-movie director, the guy who, I think his most recent work's been through Sci-Fi Channel doing films for them. But, you know, people like James Cameron, Francis Ford Coppola, Joe Dante, Gail Ann Hurd, Jack Nicholson, Charles Bronson, Sandra Bullock, Robert De Niro. These are all people who got their starts in one of Roger Corman's low-budget B-films, either in front of the camera or behind the camera. So, I mean, you know, he has had a huge impact. But he started New World Pictures in order to finance his films and in order to distribute his films in 1970. And in 1988, and this is from Cassandra Peterson, in doing research for this show, for this episode, I listened to a couple of podcasts where they interviewed her, where she talked about the New World went bankrupt. She says literally the day Elvira was supposed to come out in theaters. So overnight, she went from a film from a major studio and a major distributor that was going to be in 2,500 theaters to 500 theaters, and none of them kept it after opening weekend. So she had 2 days, 3 days, and 500 theaters nationwide in order to turn a profit on the film. And they did not, obviously. Like I said, it was one of the biggest flops of the year. I don't have confirmation of that, and I'm not going to speculate on that, because I'm not sure that those awards were around then. But anyway, and the thing is, this from the interview, she said they didn't keep the film in theaters because they just didn't have a reason to honor the contract, didn't have anyone really to give the money to, and she herself has never received royalties from the film. She says all the money she made from it came up front. So she wrote the film, produced the film, all that she got, before the film was made and during the making of the film was all she's ever gotten out of the movie. And NBC actually owns it now. And what made it so bad is it flopped in theaters, but a couple of years later they did a Saturday night special screening of it, and it was one of the highest rated events they did that year on NBC. So the movie's got, it's a good film. It's a nice, light, fun film. It's got the, if you like UHF from Weird Al, it's got that kind of humor to it. It's the, quick talking, pay attention to what they're saying, how they're saying it. There's not a lot of visual gags in the film, but, to me, I may be biased because, as I've said, I had been watching her on Movie Macabre for years at this point when the film came out. And so I knew her style of humor. I liked it. I liked the show, everything about it. So I was kind of excited to see what she would do with a bigger budget and to see with an actual story where she could go with the character. So I might be a little biased. If you're not familiar with her, if you're not big on that kind of humor, I can understand. There's a lot of people who call it stupid. To me, it's just sort of campy. It's I don't know. It kind of reminds me of the Looney Tunes, or to use one, a reference from around the same time, like a Tiny Toons. They're witty, and they're fast talking, and any adult humor is just sort of slipped in really quick. And one of those where you kind of sit there for a second because they'll throw something in right on top of it, so that you have to kind of wonder a couple times, like, did I really hear her say that? Like my two favorite examples are when she's in town, she's walking by the movie theater, and the guy hanging the letters up on the marquee drops one, hits her in the head, and he comes off the ladder, and he's like, "How's your head?" And she very not even taking a breath or pause, and is like, "No one's ever complained." And he's like, "What?" She's like, "Huh? Oh, I'll live." Or later on, one of the people on the council, city council, is complaining, and complaining about one of the other members, and said that pervert, and the guy didn't even look at her. So he goes, "I never laid a hand on those sheep." So it's just, and I'm chuckling at it. But if you into that kind of humor, then this is the movie for you. So what is the story? Well, we start off with her in Hollywood, hosting another bad movie and wanting to start a show in Vegas, which, is kind of the opposite of Cassandra Peterson's life. It was, I'm going to diverge from this, because like I said, I listened to several podcasts where they interviewed her and she talked about her life. Cassandra Peterson as a person is so much like, the old authors like you learned about in school, like Hemingway or some of them, where they'll, before they took up writing, they did, bullfighting, and they were reporters in the war, and they worked for the OSS, and there's like all these things they did before they started writing. And Cassandra Peterson is the same way. She talked about she created Elvira at 30, and she had done like some small roles before that, but it's like she was the youngest showgirl in Vegas history. She got her start at the Dunes when she was 17. It's like she said, I couldn't gamble, I couldn't drink, but I could dance topless, and nobody even thought about it. But she worked there for like a year. She went on a date with singer Tom Jones, and according to her, lost her virginity to him. And from there, she like went to Paris and danced. She went to Italy. She went to Florida and worked for one of the Playboy clubs. She was the lead singer for a disco group called Mama's Boys for 2 years. Had small parts in various films, including one of the Cheech and Chong movies. And did all this before she became Elvira. And it's just amazing. In fact, they asked her, do you have any regrets on your life? And she says, yeah, I wish I'd thought up Elvira at 20 instead of 30. And I mean, that's just, it's a great little thing. But it was just amazing. And, she co-wrote the film. She, she's had such a career. And then, to hit with this, and that's what she's known for. It's just, it's amazing. But like I said, in a reverse of her actual life, Elvira wants to go to Vegas and have a Vegas show. And she quits her job. Well, she kind of quits, gets fired from her job as a TV hostess, and her agent warns her she needs to raise $50,000 in order to help bankroll the show so that the casino isn't taking all the risk. And she's not sure how to do this, but then she finds out a great aunt she has passed away, and it's a nice little montage of her driving cross country to Falwell, Massachusetts. And in the coolest car ever. I don't care. You guys can have your DeLoreans. You can have your Ecto-1. I want the Macabre Mobile. And at one point, I actually had the model from Ertel. I think that's how I always pronounced it. It's ERTL. They made a ton of cars late 80s, early 90s, I went through a model building phase, but I loved that car. I loved putting it together, the barbed wire license plates, the skull shifter, all that. To this day, I still want that car. Still my favorite car out of any film. But she drives across the country, accidentally blows up a gas station at one point, and her car finally falls apart in Falwell, Massachusetts, as I said. And they could not have picked a better name for this town. A lot of you listening to this may not be old enough to remember. I'm old enough to remember the televangelist-filled 80s and all that scandal went down. All the scandal that went down. I mean, at one point, you had, besides Jerry Falwell, well, some of you might know Falwell from his son, Jerry Falwell Jr. And yeah, the apple, worm-riddled apple didn't fall far from the tree in that case. Jerry Falwell was, I'm just going to, he's from my home state, but he founded a university, but at the same time, Jerry Falwell is just human excrement in a trash bag stuffed into a cheap blue suit. That's all he is. That's all he ever was. He's a con man. Just like Oral Roberts, just like Jimmy Swaggart, just like Jim Baker. He was no different. The only thing is he never got caught at doing what he is doing. That's literally the only difference between him and any of the others. Just one of these people that decides to inflict their morals upon you. And, any other way of thinking other than his is wrong and sinful. So, yeah, perfect name. Like I said, late 1988 film. Yeah, perfect name for the town. Perfect attitude for everyone who lives in it. Because they're all the parody of the perfect little American white Christian Republican view of the world at the time. And Elvira is just, you know, the complete opposite of all of that to all the adults. Teenagers love her, which of course causes friction between her and more friction between her and the adults. And when she goes to her aunt's will reading, she finds out that she's been given the house, she's been given the her aunt's cookbook, and the aunt's dog, Algonquin. And, you know, the funny thing is, one of the driving things in the film is the town wants her to leave, but nobody bothers to figure out that, no, she wants to leave too. She wants to sell the house, wants to sell the cookbook. She just wants money so that she can go to Vegas and start her show. But neither one of them, you know, wants to talk to each other and get it over with. And another source of conflict is she falls in love with a local man named Bob, who one of the other women in town has been chasing, apparently, for years. And so there's all these little things going. Her uncle actually convinces her to sell him the cookbook for $50, but Algonquin, or Gonk, continues to hide it. He refuses to let her do this, and she's not sure why. And poor Gonk gets a nice makeover from Elvira. He's a white poodle at first, and then she turns him into let's say a pink mohawk, black and pink ears, spiked dog collar. She punks him up pretty good. But you find out Elvira, when she stays there in the night, she has a dream from her dead great aunt, who explains everything, that Elvira is the latest descendant of a long line of witches. She was sent away because she has the power. She has a power that her uncle craves. Her uncle wants the book so that he can use it during the next lunar eclipse to become the master of the night. And she has to do everything she can to keep the book out of his hands. And, you know, she's, you know, doesn't really care about any of that. She still just wants to fix the house up enough to sell it and to get out of town. And the local teens help her. And then she, gets to go out on a date with Bob after her house is fixed up. And she decides to use her aunt's cookbook to make them a nice dish, and instead summon some kind of monster that they wind up killing in a nice little slapstick sequence that attacks them out of the pot. And they wind up feeding it to the garbage disposal in the kitchen. But then, instead of, you know, maybe taking her great aunt's words to heart and thinking there might be a problem in town or something that she needs to be done, she instead uses another recipe to make a dish for the town potluck at the local park. And they kind of imply she tried to make the same dish and may have done something wrong. But instead of another monster attacking the townspeople, it instead turns into an aphrodisiac. And it's PG-13, but it's also not really... They don't really flinch away from what's going on, even though they do keep it PG-13. But at this point, they use an old law on the books to accuse her of witchcraft and lock her up, and the teens try to rescue her, and they wind up in jail. And Bob tries to go get the book so that he can use it to escape. And her great uncle Vincent knocks Bob out, and he gains all this power. And then they try to burn poor Elvira at the stake, and she manages to use enough power of her own in order to cause a rainstorm to put the fire out. But then her uncle shows up, and he just starts, you know, wreaking havoc with his magic. He's turned people into pigs. He's blowing things up. He's just, you know, general mayhem. And it's up to Elvira to stop him. And she tries so hard. She tries so hard. He actually winds up getting the other piece he needs, her magic ring, in order to gain even more power. She tries to blow him up. And it all comes down to a fight in her great aunt's house, and the house winds up being burnt to the ground. Vincent gets killed, And the townspeople learn the error of their ways and offer to help rebuild her house and offer, you know, let her stay there. And, you know, her and Bob's in love. But then her car gets fixed and she finds out as the only living relative of her uncle, she gets a ton of money. And so naturally she heads off to Vegas, and that's where the movie ends, is us seeing her perform in her Vegas show. And let me tell you, not going to spoil it for you, but yeah, she still remembers a lot of stuff from her showgirl days, apparently. It's again, it's not an R-rated film, but they do skirt the line, in some of the moves she executes on screen, but that's pretty much the film. Like I said, it's a very light story, very fluffy story. I mean, you're not going into this looking for something serious. You're not going into this. It's a popcorn film. It's a sugar floss, cotton candy kind of film. It's something you put in when you're in a silly mood and you just want a good laugh, or you just want something, you know, to put on for a little noise that you might not have to pay attention to so much in order to get. I mean, there's enough there for a story, but it's not something that's going to require all your attention. And there's all these great little quips in it, all these great little lines, looks, mugging, you know, Elvira mugging for the camera, things like that. You know, and at the end of the day, it's not a great film, but it is a fun film. And it's a funny film. And again, I might be biased because I'm coming into it from, 5, 6 years watching her on a Movie Macabre. And there's just a cute little, well, to me it's a personal Easter egg, but one of my favorite low budget horrible films of all time is Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. And I might talk about it on this podcast. It is very low budget, very badly. I've never seen a good print of it. I don't know if they just, that no one's ever done a restoration or what. But yeah, low budget, just parody of the disaster and animal attack films of the late 70s featuring giant tomatoes. And I recently rewatched it. My daughter is at the age where she's starting to get into horror movies, starting to get into anime, starting to get into stuff. And it popped, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes popped up on, I think, Amazon Prime. And she's like, what is that? And I was like, you want to watch it? And we actually watched it together, and she was laughing at it. But the Movie Macabre, Elvira's Movie Macabre, was the first place I ever saw the film. Like, watching it one Saturday night, I think I'm on at like 10 o'clock. Maybe one of the first episodes I remember seeing, and I fell in love with the film. And there's a sequence in this movie where she does her movie hostess gig at the local theater, and the film they're showing is Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. So, I just got a kick out of that, and felt like it was something I should share with you guys, because I loved it. Just a nice little memory, and bad film that I get to pass on to my daughter. Getting to a little trivia about the movie. As I mentioned, there was the distributor went bankrupt right as it was getting ready to be released. But a couple other little things. Brad Pitt actually auditioned for the film. It would have been one of his first film roles, and Cassandra Peterson actually marked down on the call sheet when he auditioned that she thought he was very attractive, but he was not hired for the film. In her own words, he was not hired for the film as one of the local teenagers who helped her out, because if he was on set, and this is from one of her interviews, if he was on set, people would not believe she would date Bob. So, apparently Brad Pitt was a little too good looking for the film. Other little thing I thought was hilarious is that when the film was released internationally, the Spanish dub of the film used the same voice actors who dubbed the Golden Girls TV show for Spanish audiences. So, you know, Elvira, Cassandra Peterson was, I think it was Blanche. So, yeah, just other, you know, fun little things about the film and about Cassandra Peterson. Let me see. Like I said, NBC owns the film currently. She doesn't make any money off of it. There's a few other things from the interview I thought was funny about her. She actually got her name Cassandra. I think I've been saying Cassandra, but I think she corrects people. It's supposed to be Cassandra, and I apologize for that. But she says she's actually named after one of her father's ex-girlfriends. And, yeah, that's a very forgiving woman, I guess. But, yeah, she was originally for Elvira. She was working with the Groundlings. In fact, that's where she met Edie McClurg, who is in this film. But, you know, they're an improv group out of Los Angeles. And she actually joked about that, because, like, nowadays, there's been so many people have come out of it that you have to go through all kinds of tests and come in with material and characters and stuff. And, like, and she actually talks about she had a routine she did with Phil Hartman at one point, who was also a member of the Groundlings at the same time. But it is so hard to get in there now. And that, and in one of the interviews, I asked her, how did you get a job with working with the Groundlings? She's like, oh, I had the money to pay the $35 a week fee in order to take the classes and be part of the show. But she was originally supposed to take over the role of Vampira, or Vampira, I've heard it pronounced both ways, who was the local horror movie hostess. But then because of some legal complications, because that's also the character from Plan 9 from Outer Space. And I didn't write it. It's one of those times, any other time I'd know who it was that played the role. Give me a second. But yeah, anyway, I'll look this up. She was offered the part and auditioned for the part, and then she was contacted while she was on her honeymoon in order to take over the role, and she turned it down because she wanted to finish her honeymoon. And then when she returned from her honeymoon, she found out the job was still open, and then they wanted an original character, and the station manager told her that he wanted, you know, he had seen her at the Groundlings, and he's like, you know, you do this Valley Girl style character. He's like, why don't you do that? And, you know, just make her scary. And she's, you know, Cassandra was like, well, that's not going to work. How's that going to work? And from that, and with the help of her friend Robert Redding, who designed a lot of the costume, built the first wig, well, did all of her wigs and did all of her costuming up through the film. Well, up till right before the filming, right before filming began, and then he passed away. You know, she created the character, and in her own words, he created the look of the character. Okay, here we go. Vampira was Mela Nurmi. I think I'm pronouncing that right. I'm Southern and old, so I don't really pronounce a lot of stuff correctly. But yeah, KABC-TV in Los Angeles. Vampira. We're going to go with Vampira, who was played by Mela Nurmi. Originally, Cassandra Peterson was offered that part, and then when they couldn't use the character anymore, she created Elvira. And the funny thing is, the TV show went out of TV KABC went out of business, but she owned the character outright, and she explained in one of the interviews that was because they refused to give her a raise. So every time she went in to negotiate for more money, they would instead give her more rights over the character. So, you know, instead of going from $300 to $350 a week, it would be like, well, Coors wants me to be in a national campaign. It's like, well, all right, we'll sign off and give you this much control over the character so you can do the campaign and get the money from that, etc. And she says, so by the time they went bankrupt, I 100% owned the character. And she actually says that's probably why she still plays Elvira, is because it's, you know, like Paul Rubens and Pee-wee Herman, when you own the character, it's a lot different than if you're playing a role somebody else created. And I think that's part of, because I've heard interviews with her where she says she would love to find somebody to take the role over so that Elvira would continue even after her. But it's hard to find somebody that embodies both sides of the character, the fun side of it and the sexy side of it, you know, the sort of tongue-in-cheek, burlesque kind of side of it. But I think that's going to be it for this week. Kind of a shorter episode, but you know, like I said, I love the movie. I love Cassandra Peterson. I love Elvira. Love that car. God, I want that car. I one other thing just dawned on me. Yeah, we back when we had arcades, we had the Elvira pinball machine, not the original one. There was actually, I didn't know this. She's actually been the star of three different pinball machines. And the first one was Elvira and the Party Monsters. And I don't really remember that one. The one we had at our mall was the Scared Stiff one, which came out several years later. And which is still to this day, it and the Addams Family, which is based on the movie, are probably my two favorite pinball machines. A lot of fun to play. But recently they released Elvira's House of Horrors, which is one that I would love to find and play, because it's not just Elvira, but apparently a lot of the movies that she made fun of on a Movie Macabre, they've licensed characters from. So you can hide little, you know, they've hidden little Easter eggs from a bunch of these films all around the machine and on the playing board and whatnot. So I just thought that was a little neat thing to share as well. But still, like I said, it's a fun movie. If you like the Weird Al, Looney Tunes, you know, fast talk, witty kind of humor. It's light. It's not too long. It's a good, just fun film you can watch, you know, with your kids even. And just, you know, pass a couple of hours, get a few chuckles out of. I recommend it if you're just in that kind of mood. And if you're not, don't worry about it. But that's going to wrap it up for this week. I'd like to thank you once again for letting me be part of your life and for taking some time out of your life in order for me to talk to you about a movie. Hope you have a good day, good week, till we meet again. Take care of yourself, because you're important. If you liked this show, give us a review wherever you got the show from. Reviews help us find new people that we can inflict this, and find new people that might enjoy the show. That's another thing. I need to come up with a name for you guys. Everybody else has something cutesy to call their followers. Let's see, what's good with, say, fever? Sufferers? Sufferers? Is that a good one? You guys want to go with it? If there's something you guys can think of as better, or a film that you want me to talk about, or something else you think I should have covered with this film, or a different film, something you want to correct me on, then, you know, hit me up on Twitter at CFeverDreams. You can hit me up on, you can hit me up with the email at CelluloidFeverDreams@gmail, though you can't spell it the way it's supposed to be because somebody else apparently already had that. It's CellulloidFeverDreams, Fever Dreams. And you can find us on Facebook at Celluloid Fever Dreams, or Instagram at Celluloid Fever Dreams. That's a lot to say. Maybe I should have picked a shorter name. But anyway, feel free to reach out and touch us. And come back next week, as we're going to be talking about a 2014 film starring Elizabeth Moss called The One I Love. Nice little freaky kind of sci-fi little thriller. One that I've never met anyone else who has seen the film, which is kind of freaky because it's a really good film. And as we head into February, we're going to be talking about some other films that I like. I'm not gonna show my hand just yet, but we didn't do a Christmas theme because we launched so close to Christmas. I didn't really want to start with that in case people came back and caught that. But for the month of February, I've got some films lined up, some of my favorite, since it is Black History Month, going back and looking at some of my favorite films by black filmmakers that I just feel don't get a lot of the love or a lot of the a lot of people talking about them like they should, because they're good movies. And until next time, I'm Wyndham Jennings. This has been Celluloid Fever Dreams, and I hope to see you again soon.